You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On September 3, 1964, President Johnson signed into law the Wilderness Act, designed to limit commercial ventures and human impact on designated land areas across the country. Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker, looks back at how that law came to pass and what it has achieved and the impact it continues to have in an article called 50 Years of Wilderness. It's in the September issue of the National Geographic magazine. I'm very pleased that it brings Elizabeth Colbert back to our show. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The great photographer Ansel Adams described wilderness as a state of mind and heart. How does the Wilderness Act describe wilderness?
Well, it uses this really interesting definition or this very lyrical description, really, almost more than a definition, as land untrammeled by man, where man is just a visitor.
Has the definition changed over the years?
No, it's sort of enshrined in that original act. But I think one thing that's really important to understand, you know, especially in this age where the concept of wilderness is very vexed and many would argue, and I think very persuasively, that there's really no place on the planet that we can call wild anymore or untouched by man, and that is certainly true. The people who wrote the Wilderness Act, you know, they were not naive. They realized that human impacts already in 1964 were very pervasive, and so they left room, you know, untrammeled by man is a pretty interesting a term, sort of not entirely under human control, but that doesn't mean untouched by people.
How does the Wilderness Act protect that untrammeled land? What does it do?
Yeah, well, it imposes some pretty, I mean, the main thrust of the Wilderness Act is really to prevent road building. If you look at the history of the Wilderness Act and how it came into being, it goes all the way back to the 1930s when there was a big push to put roads in a lot of our national parks and a lot of the very famous roads that people take now and enjoy driving through the national parks were put in during they were sort of Depression era building projects. And a group of people in the Forest Service, including Aldo Leopold, looked at this and said, okay, we're really, you know, turning our national parks, our most fantastic landscapes, into so many roadside attractions, and this isn't really what we want. And they pushed and pushed. It took 30 years for the act to finally be passed and signed. It was a big legislative battle and a lot of people and a lot of persistence to get it passed, a lot of drafts. And when it was finally passed, it just imposes this separate layer of protection on already protected federal lands. So all these lands usually tend to be either already in the national park system or the national forest system. And it says, you know, we're not going to have motorized traffic in them. We're not going to have mining operations in them. And so there's just a sort of extra layer of protection on them.
Is there such a thing as overuse of national parks? I mean, how do we encourage awareness of national parks and wilderness centers without bringing a lot of traffic into them?
Yes, I think that you can certainly make the case. Look, we want as many people in our national parks as possible to be able to experience them, and certainly roads, you know, are part of that. But I also think, you know, there's plenty of space, and you know, this isn't really just my opinion. It's obviously the opinion, as it were, right now of the people of the U.S. after the Wilderness Act was passed. But there's room also for places that do take a fair amount of effort to get into. Now, wilderness areas are, I want to say, and I've been to some that are not very difficult to get into. They run the gamut from places that are really tough to get to. You really have to hike in quite a ways to places that are, you know, start 10 feet, you know, from the nearest road. So in the story, I visit a wilderness area in New Hampshire, a designated wilderness area that, you know, we drove to the trailhead and then we started walking.
So it's pretty much allowing people entry through hiking, and that's it.
Yes, exactly.
Has the act undergone any revisions over the years?
Well, a very serious, it wasn't a revision, it was sort of an addendum. occurred in the mid-1970s, because the way the act was sort of originally written and originally interpreted, at least, it really only applied to Western lands that had not, say, you know, we hadn't come through and logged them all. And people decided, well, we should have wilderness areas, even in the east, in the eastern U.S., where, you know, most of our forests had been cut down, timbered at a certain point. And so there was an Eastern Wilderness Act that was passed in the mid-70s to allow land sort of east of the Mississippi to be designated as wilderness. There are far fewer wildernesses and far less area protected as wilderness in or designated as wilderness east of the Mississippi, but they do exist.
When the law was passed, there were 54 wilderness areas. How many are there today?
Today there are hundreds. It's over 700. The number, you know, just changed fairly recently. There was one addition to the Wilderness Act, and one which was in Michigan. And I think one thing that's important, you know, to note is the Wilderness Act, when it was passed, had a lot of bipartisan support. It has traditionally had a lot of bipartisan support, but in recent years, this recent, you know, five-year period or so, has been a historic low for designating new wilderness areas, and they are now getting stacked up. And so there are a bunch of bills, almost 30 bills, that have bipartisan support from the area in which the wilderness would be designated. So there's a lot of local support for them, but this Congress has basically just refused to designate new lands as wilderness. And I think, personally, I think that that is a very sad state of affairs. It goes along with a lot of things that this Congress has refused to take up, and it's really just a big backlog at this point.
What are their reasons for refusing? Just simply the situation that is typical in Congress these days, or are there real objections to expanding the Wilderness Act?
Well, I think it's more the typical, you know, sort of do-nothing Congress, but there are objections in the global sense. I suppose some people have, you know, simply ideological objections to designating land as wilderness. It does take it out of, say, timber production, you know, permanently, on a permanent basis. That is the whole point of it. It takes it out of, you know, various forms of extraction that we do allow, for example, in national forests and in places like that, energy extraction. And I think that there are, you know, many members of Congress at this point who, unfortunately, you know, see any kind of conservation efforts as anathema. How's that? Mm-hmm. And why we can't get a lot of things done that are in the national interest, that are in the interest of all of us, but are not necessarily in the interest of extractive industries.
The Federal Wilderness Act underwent 60 drafts, so there were people who were had problems with it even then. Was the power of the bill diluted throughout the various drafts?
Well, there were a lot of issues, and I don't want to, you know, claim to be an expert on this, but there were a lot of issues that had to do with claims, and this gets into the very complicated way that federal lands are, you know, overseen, and there are a lot of leases on federal lands, as everybody knows, for extractive industries. And so, you know, especially out west, where there are a lot of big financial interests potentially in those national forests or lands that had other, you know, sort of protective designations on them, but were still being used for, you know, very serious economically lucrative activities, and where people might have claims, you know, you had to adjudicate a lot of that. And so there was things that were grandfathered in. For example, you couldn't, for example, put new mining claims into wilderness lands after those sort of lapsed in the 80s, for example. So there was a 20-year period in there. So there were a lot of just complicated things to work out in the legislation.
Elizabeth Culbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her article, 50 Years of Wilderness, is in the September issue of another magazine, National Geographic. And that we are talking about the Wilderness Act and what has happened in the 50 years since it was enacted on September 3rd, 1964. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Elizabeth Culbert, whose article, 50 Years of Wilderness, is in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. There are there were earlier attempts before the federal government got involved to protect the environment. You mentioned Aldo Leopold. He was successful in protecting land at the state level in New Mexico in 1924. Do many states have their own versions of wilderness acts?
Well, that was actually a designation that through the Forest Service. He worked for the Forest Service, and the Forest Service sort of internally came up with this designation. And the idea was, could we sort of extend that to other federal agencies and federal lands? So lands that come under wilderness protection, as I say, they always have they're always federal lands, and they usually have another designation, and the wilderness designation is laid on top of them. But we have all sorts of different federal lands. So, for example, you know, we have national parks, we have national forests, and he wanted, the wilderness, and the Wilderness Society grew out of this effort. It was created to sort of push for this concept. That there were all sorts of federal lands that could potentially be eligible for wilderness designation, not just forest lands.
You speak of local support. Are you talking about local citizens, or are we talking about politicians in these areas? Don't some people object because they see these the extension of wilderness areas as job killers?
Well, in order for a bill to get as far as these 30 bills or so that I alluded to before, in order for them to get as far as they've gotten, they typically and almost always have a great deal of local support, and they have support from the local congressional delegation. So, you know, yes, there are definitely often, you know, very contentious battles at the local or state level over whether lands should be put into wilderness designation, but those that have gotten to this point are lands that people often feel, you know, are very special places to the people who live near them and around them and who visit them, and they want them to have this layer of protection on them. So usually those battles, I don't want to say that they're not a lot of battles, but usually those battles, by the time they get, you know, to having a bill placed before Congress, have been played out, and people have decided, okay, this is what we want, and they've, you know, worked through those issues, and then the bill goes to Congress. And in previous Congresses, it was pretty much, okay, if the local people want it, you know, if we've reached this stage, Congress will support it. That is sort of the way the process has worked. It is only in very recent years, as I say, like the last 5 years or so, that has not happened, and that these bills have gone through this process but still can't get through Congress.
Do you think that if President Obama opposed these bills that they might get through?
That's a very interesting tactic. That's something worth thinking about.
Are there economic advantages to keeping land untouched by humans?
You know, there are certainly economic advantages in a somewhat diffuse way, and that's what the battle over a lot of our, you know, protecting a lot of places in this country and in this world are about, right? So, for example, one thing that wilderness lands do, and it's hard to quantify, but it's very clearly true, is they're very important for water sources, for clean water. A lot of our, you know, waters originate in wilderness areas that people are drinking, say, in big metropolitan areas. And if we were to, you know, wreck those in some way and have to pay for our drinking water or have to treat it or whatever, obviously there's a huge cost, but that cost is spread among all of us. So what you often have in these battles are a very great and large and potentially quantifiable public good, you know, facing off against a private good. Someone has, say, you know, as I say, a mining concession or a timber concession that they don't want to lose. And those are difficult battles, but I think that the key in a lot of them that unfortunately has been lost, and certainly has been lost in this particular Congress, is, you know, the public interest involved in preserving these lands, which we can't, as I say, always put an exact dollar figure on, but which are very, very significant, and very significant in dollar terms.
Don't scientists learn from plant and animal species in the wild?
Absolutely. Now, I don't think that any any scientist would say that, you know, they can't learn about plant and animal species from lands that are not designated wilderness, but certainly there's a lot of important research going on in wilderness areas. And one of the really interesting, you know, questions that people are asking right now, and crucial questions, is, for example, how are all plants and animals responding to climate change? And when the wilderness areas are, in a sense, you could argue they're the laboratories for this great experiment that we're conducting on the entire planet right now, changing the climate everywhere and in wilderness areas, which are, you know, relatively untrammeled by man, we can see to what extent, you know, new communities of plants and animals are forming. And I think one of the arguments that I make in the piece, and that people made to me when I did a lot of interviews on this topic, that scientists made to me, is that we really need more than ever these large tracts of roadless lands where species that are on the move, many, many species are on the move trying to track the climate, can find their way, right? We are blocking the paths of many, many species by our cities and our airports and our malls and our roads. So wilderness areas, in some sense, provide the best chance for species that need to be on the move.
You write that designating land as wilderness represents an act of humility.
Yeah, and that is, once again, you know, a theme that many people raised with me, and I think it's a very important point that, you know, we are conducting this vast global experiment, and when we designate a land as wilderness, we are not saying it's unaffected by people, but we are saying we are going to try to keep our hands off of it as much as possible. We realize that we don't, you know, understand everything about this system, and we don't control everything about the system, even though we have set in motion all these things that have tremendous global effects. We really don't know what the end result of them is going to be. And so by leaving, you know, pretty big tracts of land as untrammeled as possible, we are allowing the natural processes that still are taking place as free rein as we can at this point.
I'm assuming that this interest of yours grows out of the work you've done on at least two books, Field Notes from a Catastrophe and The Sixth Extinction, which are both about the environment.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, climate change is very often referred to as this grand geophysical experiment, and there's no control on that experiment. You know, we never set aside a planet that we're not doing this experiment on. So the best that we have, the best hope that we have, that there are places that are going to emerge from this experiment with new communities of plants and animals are going to be, you know, places, I think, or at least one possibility is they will be places where we let, you know, evolution, as it were, and adaptation take their own path.
Some critics worry that certain places are being privileged at the expense of others. A swamp is not as pleasing to the eye as a mountain range or a deep canyon. Are all types of wilderness being preserved, even the ugly ones?
That's a very good question. I think that if you look at the list of places that have been preserved, and they range from, you know, the very tiny, actually, I mean, I keep sort of alluding to big chunks of land, and there are very large wildernesses, especially, you know, up in Alaska, actually. But they range from pretty tiny little islands, to swamps, to mountaintops. I'm sure it's true, you know, that we tend to privilege the scenic. And if you look at the lovely, really great pictures that are in National Geographic, you certainly see wilderness as spectacular. Some of these wilderness areas are just spectacularly beautiful.
Listeners can view photography from the article on our show page at WNYC.org. We have some of them.
They do, you know, if you look, you can find a list, you know, to be honest, on Wikipedia, of every wilderness area in the country, and you'll see that they do span, you know, desert to swamp to and really just about any kind of ecosystem you can think of. And I want to credit the photographer on that piece, who is Michael Melford.
Are there wilderness preservation laws in other countries, or international conservation efforts?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I do not want to say definitively that there are not, but I think that the Wilderness Act would be considered unique, really, actually. And wilderness as a concept, even when you think about it, is something that is I don't want to say it's unique to the U.S., but it's very much a part of our heritage, really. And one argument that is made, you know, in addition to sort of the argument about the experience that people have of going to wilderness and the experience that and the environmental benefits of having wilderness is simply as part of our heritage. We are a country where the idea of wilderness was very important. It was very important to our
going back to the 19th century.
Yes, exactly, and that we're sort of preserving this ideal, even as we understand, you know, that it's been challenged on all sorts of fronts, and that the lands that are, you know, that the colonials came and found were not wilderness. They had been inhabited, you know, by people, by Native Americans, for thousands and thousands of years. So it's a vexed history. I think that is absolutely true, but it is also part of our sort of national identity.
And there's always pressure in other countries. In Africa, we see it where, on the one hand, there are many people who would like to see parks and preserves established. On the other hand, people are saying we need to farm. We have to just get food to survive.
Yes, and I mean, there are many obviously countries that have, you know, have national parks. I mean, that's certainly not unique at all. And if you are in Brazil now, for example, vast tracts of the Amazon now have some kind of protection on them. I think that, you know, it's just the wilderness ideal per se is not necessarily part of many countries' heritages, but, you know, land protection is, obviously.
Several projects and events have been scheduled to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and listeners can find out about them by going to wilderness50th.org. Do you know about that?
I do not know about that. I'm very glad to be informed of that, yeah.
And as I said before, our listeners can also find photography from the article on our show page at WNYC.org. The article is 50 Years of Wilderness in the September issue of National Geographic. And my great thanks to Elizabeth Colbert for being on our show again.
Oh, thanks for having me.